You're listening to the Missiology Podcast. In this episode, your host, Martin Rodriguez, sits down with Amos Young, director of the Center for Missiological Research at Fuller Theological Seminary and professor of theology and mission at Fuller School of Intercultural Studies. They discuss Dr. Young's experiences in the study of mission and his hope for the future of the field.
Dr. Young, thank you so much for being with us on Missiology Podcast, and I appreciate your time. So my first question is about a primary experience that has shaped your missiology. Tell me about a high point as a practitioner or scholar in the field, a time when you felt engaged or motivated, an experience that has shaped your missiology. What happened? Who was involved? What did you do?
Thank you, Martin. Appreciate inviting me to do this. So I wasn't trained as a missiologist, and I actually woke up at one point when I was 10 years old to what I later on figured out was as a reverse MK, meaning that my parents were missionaries from Malaysia coming to North America to work among Chinese-speaking immigrants in 1976. Of course, at that point in time, they didn't know that they were reverse missionaries, but the last couple decades, that language has become prominent to describe people who come from Asia, Africa, Latin America to North America to do ministry, mission, evangelistic work, and so on. So I grew up as a pastor's kid turned missionary kid, just a kid as far as I was concerned. I went on and I was actually trained as a theologian rather than as a missiologist. I do remember that when I finished my PhD in the late 1990s and growing up as a Pentecostal, my parents are still Assemblies of God pastors, I suppose, reverse missionaries. And I've had Assemblies of God credentials for the last 30 years. I did realize that a lot of what the Pentecostal movement was known for was its missionary endeavors. And I was aware of some of the literature that was coming out by Pentecostals that were missiological. But because I was one of the few Pentecostals trained as a systematician, as a theologian, I felt the burden of having to earn my bona fides, if you will, as a theologian. So I very clearly avoided and I steered away from missiological related topics. My topic, however, was in the realm called theology of religion. So I was looking at how do we understand the fact of the actuality of other religions and so on. So that was a lot of the work I did in the first probably 10 years had to do with that. In 2007 or so, this was my second or third year at Regent University, I've been involved with the National Council of Churches on a few projects. They were always interested in getting Pentecostal perspectives because of the growing recognition of the importance of Pentecostal churches and movements in not only North America but around the world. So I've been involved in some National Council of Churches conversations as a Pentecostal theologian and got involved in a group that was thinking about the legacy of what happened with the mission to Native America. Jamestown was in Virginia, where, if you will, the folks from the old world landed in North America. And as we all know, the mission to the Native Americans has been genocidal in some respects. It's been a very horrid history from certain perspectives. In any case, at Regent University, which was also in Virginia, not too far from actually the site, Colonial Jamestown, actually, I was teaching there at the time. And I got involved organizing a conference, and a book came out of that called Remembering Jamestown, Hard Questions About Christian Mission. And the book was edited by myself and Barbara Brown Zickman, who was also affiliated with the National Council of Churches in some other respects. We had some Native theologians, missiologists, some Pentecostal ones, others that provided us with some historical perspective, one on the doctrine of discovery and how that was used as a missiological tool, so to speak, quote-unquote missiological tool. And so this was a book that we published in 2010, and this was the first book that I'd published up to that point with the word mission in the title. Right, so this was my long efforts to avoid doing anything on missiology. Obviously, I failed. And it was my point of entry into missiology, if you will, almost from the worst possible angle. Right? Because, Pentecostalism is a very triumphalistic sort of movement to begin with. And it's, to the ends of the earth sort of character exhibits the same sort of, if you will, energy, aggressiveness, triumphalism in some respects. So engaging with missiology from the standpoint of the history of mission in the Americas, in North America particularly, and engaging with indigenous populations opened me up to, if you will, the dark side of mission. It opened me up to studying Pentecostal engagements with Native communities. I started becoming more familiar with some of the history, particularly around those engagements. I mean, as a Pentecostal theologian, a scholar of Pentecostalism, someone who was supposedly an expert on the movement, you know, those sides of the Pentecostal story are hardly ever told, right? Because the natives don't really live to tell about it, on the one hand, and of course, all you hear on the mainline, on the denominational side, are all the purified versions of these stories. And was also very consistent with the work I did on the religions, because you know, engaging with Native traditions, Native communities, Native cultures involves the work of thinking about the religions and indigenous traditions, indigenous religious traditions, and so on. So shortly after that, I co-authored a book that also came out of a conference with Clifton Clark, who was also at Regent with me at the time, and he since joined me here at Fuller. This was a conference we held, and the title of it was now called Global Renewal, Religious Pluralism, and the Great Commission, and the subtitle, Toward a Renewal Theology of Mission and Interreligious Encounter. Again, this was consistent with the work I'd done on theology of religions, but we were really looking more particularly at how do Pentecostal movements think missiologically about interreligious encounter? Mm-hmm. How do Pentecostal movements think missionally about relating to people of other faiths? And so the second book with Dr. Clark came out of a conference that we organized at Regent in the School of Divinity as part of our Renewal Studies program, whereas the previous version, volume, Remembering Jamestown, it was organized at Regent, but Regent really just hosted the conversation rather than, if you will, sponsored it in any sort of formal sense, right? So those are my first two books, actually, with the word mission in title, that came out of my work really in ecumenical dialogue, in terms of interreligious dialogue, and opened me up, I think, some of the very important questions with regard to missiology today.
Hmm. So as you think back on both of those two conferences and the two books that have come out of those conferences, and you're thinking back about those actual conferences, are there things that stand out to you as memories from those two gatherings that you had at Regent?
Sure. I mean, so, you know, George Tinker, Tink Tinker, was one of the attendees and the contributors, and if you know of his work, and of course I'd known of his work before, but since, and of course he's one of those Native theologians, you know, I would say he's a Christian. I don't think that he rejects the label of being a Christian, but I would say that he is also kind of like a James Cone, who says that we need to think about Christianity in its specificity and the ways in which it has engaged with certain populations and certain groups. And so he's basically called for a moratorium on Christian mission, at least as defined, exemplified, and carried out in the encounter with Native America. Obviously, from that point of view, he would not be considered a friend of mission, but I think that if we took that history seriously, most of us probably wouldn't be quote-unquote friends of mission, right. At least not in the way in which it unfolded across mm-hmm. Native America. So engaging with him, I think, was very important. Richard Twist was a part of that conversation. He's since passed away. He obviously was in many respects very different from Tinker as an evangelical. Engaging with the evangelical, white evangelicalism, basically as a Native theologian. So being able to engage with Tinker and Twist in the same forum, I think, was quite, is very jarring in some respects, because they represent, if you will, very, very different perspectives. But of course, Twist himself has always been, suspected in the evangelical community, for whom, you know, certain notions of mission seem to be more or less taken for granted, and very little capacity to really be critically self-engaged about the history of that. two others I think was very interesting. One was actually a professor at, I want to say, the University of Richmond or something like that in Virginia. But Edward Bond, he was a historian, but a historian of the doctrine of discovery in particular. He was a historian of early Anglicanism in North America, and so was able to fill out some of the early developments in terms of how the church used the doctrine of discovery to further its mission endeavors, which of course was a very interesting perspective in the sense that, you know, Paul and the apostles in the first century used the law as it was at the time to carry out and follow in obedience to what they felt the call of the gospel was. So there are some parallels, but it's interesting again how these parallels can be seen also to be at cross purposes. Mm-hmm. One final person who I'll name, Barbara Alice Mann, not a Christian, but she's a native historian as well. And, you know, I really appreciated how she was willing to be a part of this conference, which is a mission conference, thinking about missiology after Jamestown, not as a Christian, being willing to talk about Native perspectives as having been on the underside of that mission history. So it was, you know, help. I think it was quite generous of her to participate in the conversation, to allow her essay to be published in this book, to, you know, illuminate the conversation from another perspective.
Mm. Why is that an important example for us, or why is that an important... So Barbara Alice Mann showing up at this conference, in what way has that, you know, perhaps, what were some of the ideas that you had even at the time?
Well, I think it's really the issue is, you know, being willing to talk about this experience, being on the receiving end of a lot of very negative attitudes, actions, and so on, being willing to at least allow a native voice to be heard within this context, a native voice that would have been a target, if you will, of Christian mission. You know, cause there were other native voices, so hers wasn't the only one. But I think, you know, as a non-Christian, being willing to be part of the conversation. So from my perspective, I think, you know, one of the ideas about mission that I'm very much, you know, and I might talk about more later on, how do we do mission with others and not just missionize them at them? Right, so that kind of a model means how do we sit down and talk with others? How do we engage in mutual witness, if you will? So I think that's an even more powerful image in the sense that she heard all of the other person's papers, and we heard her paper. She gave a native voice that wasn't, maybe you could say, was an attempt to convert our thinking about native perspectives. And I think that's what I mean when I talk about mutual witness, is that you know, the capacity to be able to bear witness to Christ on the one hand, but yet at the same time the capacity to be able to attend to the voices of others and what they have to say on the other hand, and then how that back and forth might have some implications for us going forward. How do we might adjust our attitudes, perceptions, ways we go about bearing witness, and so on.
Really good. Thank you. My second question is about how you've been influenced by other missiologists, other practitioners. Maybe name a couple of books, maybe one or two primary books or conversations that you've had that have contributed to your research, your ministry. What was the content of those conversations and why did they make a difference for you?
So probably less, you know, I'm two books come to mind, actually, less conversations. I mean, some of the conversations I've already mentioned already. But certainly I would say that, you know, a book that you're very familiar with, David Bosch, Transforming Mission. When I first picked it up, and I don't even remember when this was, but it would have to be about 20 years ago, I would say, late 90s, early 2000s. Here was of course, Bosch is a New Testament scholar, but here was a wide-ranging view of missiology. And a very theologically inviting view of missiology. So even though I was a theologian that didn't really want to be known as doing missiology, I could see that many of the missiological questions that Bosch was addressing were deeply theological. They had to do with salvation. They had to do with other religions. They had to do with peace, justice. They had to do with crossing cultures. All the kinds of stuff I was doing as a theologian. Yeah. But because in some respects, even in the late 90s and early 2000s, theology was in one domain and missiology was in another domain. By the way, that same division remains here at Fuller Seminary in a certain respect, right? Mm-hmm. We've got the School of Theology and we've got the School of Intercultural Studies. So in some respects, this is a remnant from a prior era in which mission and theology were seen as maybe related but distinctive domains. But Bosch's treatment, and of course Bosch's treatment as a New Testament scholar, is one, I think, powerful step forward for helping us to see that while there may have been good reasons for keeping these domains separate at some time in the past, going forward, they're more and more going to be intertwined for all of us. And so, in some respects, Bosch gave me permission to begin to think missiologically, or at least gave me permission to say that I can potentially do missiology as a theologian. I remember publishing, again, I think I mentioned that 2009 or 10 was when my Jamestown came out, but 5 years before that, I was already publishing articles with the word mission in the title. I'm publishing in international, Bulletin Missionary Research, and a number of these other journals that had the word mission in the title. Mm-hmm. So I'd already begun to kind of step out of my theological bubble mm-hmm. into the arena of missiology. But again, the invitation was basically Bosch inviting me as a New Testament scholar and inviting me to think theologically about these issues. So I was already well on my way by the time Jamestown came out. The second thing, or now I want to step back a little bit, because in some respects, Clark Pinnock's book, A Flame of Love, A Theology of the Holy Spirit, really marks me as a theologian probably, in some respects, probably as one of maybe a handful of two or three books going back. So that book was published in 1996, 1995, 1996, when I started my PhD studies. Mm-hmm. And what Pinnock was a New Testament scholar who was basically raised in a cessationist, fundamentalist Baptist context, and in the late 60s came into charismatic renewal, and that basically torpedoed his fundamentalism and set him out on a theological path that kept him asking questions. And so this book, now 1996, it's a little bit misleading. It says it's a theology of the Holy Spirit, but it's really a theology looked at through the perspective of the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. He looks at soteriology. He looks at doctrine of God. He looks at ecclesiology. He looks at other religions. He looks at eschatology, all from what I would now call a pneumatological perspective. In other words, how does this doctrine look differently if we think about it pneumatologically, or from the perspective of the person and work of the Holy Spirit? So my work in theology of religions was on pneumatology and theology of religions. How do we think about the religions if we think about the person and work of the Spirit? And in many ways, you could say that all of my theological sojourn, including my sojourn into missiology, has been sort of driven by these kinds of pneumatological sensibilities, impulses, inquiries. Is now my question would be, how do we think about mission pneumatologically from the perspective of the person and work of the Spirit, which in some respects actually has been much more closer. Pneumatology and missiology have probably been closer historically than probably some of the other doctrinal loci. There are certain things that pneumatology is closer to, and missiology is one of them. Mm-hmm. Other things that pneumatology has been further from. Mm-hmm. But in any case, my springboard into theology was through pneumatology, and that sort of carried over as well, I think, for me. I do think that asking the pneumatological question in missiology does keep things really, really interesting in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Thank you. We might come back to that.
Yep.
The third question that I have for you is explicitly about God's agency in your life as a missiologist. Can you describe a time or recall a time that you recognized that God was shaping you shaping you for this work of missiology that you are very much now a part of, and came in some ways through a back door. Tell me perhaps how this happened. Can you think of this point in this time or an example?
I think the one event that jumps out at me is in the spring of 2014, actually. I had a phone conversation with a good friend. His name is Terry Monk. And if you know Terry, you'll realize that, he's been at the forefront of the evangelical sort of conversation as a missiologist, as as a scholar of world Christianity. But he was actually trained in religious studies as an expert on the Theravada Buddhist tradition. And so he's done a lot of work over the decades in the Society for Buddhist Christian Studies. He's practically been one person as an evangelical in this society until I showed up. And so he'd been a mentor, given my work, my interest in East Asian traditions, given my work in theology of religions. He was like one of the few evangelicals that I felt I could lean on and be encouraged by as a model, as an exemplar. How do we navigate asking these sorts of questions in evangelical Pentecostal worlds that look at religious others, including Buddhists, as objects to be evangelized rather than as conversation partners about witness? So, again, he's been an ongoing conversation partner, and I dedicated one of my books that I published in that year to him. But he gave me a call early in 2014, and he asked me the question. He said, "Hey, Fuller Seminary, their School of Intercultural Studies, they might be looking for somebody. Would you be interested?" And at that point I said, "Huh." I said, "I've got a daughter and going to Vanguard University. I've got another daughter going to Point Loma Nazarene University. They're both in South..." I was in Virginia Beach in Virginia at the time. And I said, "Well, why not?" At that point, I published my third book with the word mission in the title. It was called Global Diasporas and Mission. And that was an edited book with the Regnum Edinburgh series that's like 40 volumes. And I was invited to join that by Wonsuk Ma and Chandler Im. They were doing a volume on diaspora and mission. And, they recognized my story with this reverse missionary story. So I co-edited the book with Chandler. That came out in 2013. So I had three books with the word mission under my name. They were all edited books, right? And I was thinking to myself, "Huh, do I actually fit as a missiologist?" I'd never thought about myself as a missiologist before that phone call. Then, of course, Scott Sundquist gave me a call because I said, go ahead and let him know. And so Scott and Terry are good friends, and Scott, as you know, is the dean here at School of Intercultural Studies. Scott gave me a call. We talked a little bit. And then I made my trip out here. And so I think that whole process, actually, I came then later that summer to the School of Intercultural Studies. But I think it was a six-month process in which I began to ask myself precisely that question that I put off at the beginning of my journey as a theologian, right? Which was, I'm a theologian, I'm not a missiologist. I remember very, very clearly delineating the parameters upon which I was willing to tread, right? And like I said, 2005, articles started coming out with the word mission and title. 2010, books started coming out with mission and title. And, when I actually came, so this was interesting. That year that I had this conversation with Terry, I was also in the process of pulling together a dozen of my previously published articles with the word mission and title into a book that I called The Missiological Spirit. And I did that project with a companion book called The Dialogical Spirit. So even in doing that project, it wasn't because I felt like I was a missiologist, but it was because I felt like I had published enough articles in missiology that potentially deserved to be pulled together as a kind of hanging together kind of a thing. But then those phone calls happened. I came out to do an interview at Fuller, and it began to dawn on me that precisely a lot of these issues that we've been talking about, the lines between theology and mission that in some respects now are very, very arbitrary, wouldn't it be kind of cool for me to re-engage with this missiological set of issues that in some respects I had been avoiding, in other respects had practically overtaken me without me even realizing that it had. But allow me to live more fully into this space and actually even invite me to further grow and explore as a theologian in a more intentional way about missiology than, I mean, because all this other stuff I was doing was sort of just kind of, you know, different things would come up, we'd do them, and it was fun. I was learning a lot, but I was a theologian. I wasn't a missiologist, right? And so so it's been a really a lot of fun the last 5 years, getting into all of the missiological themes and topics, kind of getting a missiological education along the way, you know, for free.
That's great. So my last question, Dr. Young, is about your hopes for the field of missiology. If you had two or three wishes about shaping missiology over the next decade or two, what would be your hopes for the changing shape of missiology?
So the first one has to do with a book that is coming out of our missiology lectures last year, and it should be in the bookstores here in the next couple of weeks. And it's entitled, Can White People Be Saved? Triangulating Race, Theology, and Mission. And by the way, the word white is in quote marks. So I'm not just talking about white people without quote marks, but white people in quote marks. So if you want to know what that really refers to, obviously you have to get the book. but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it is the big question of how can we imagine mission, Christian witness in a 21st century that goes in multiple directions, not just from Europe and North America in elsewhere, but coming from these other parts of the world as well, and being carried by a variety of different currents going in different directions, linguistic currents, cultural currents, political currents, economic currents. And so I think that this book, and it's an edited book, but I think that it does in many ways raise important questions and chart some important trajectories for mission in the next generation. Second would be the conference that we're having in 2019, fall of 2019, in a year. We're building the preliminary website for it right now. And the exact title I'm going to have to beg off for a moment, but it has to do with what we're calling techno-sapientialism, or the techno-sapiential world, meaning, you know, we're all embedded now within a digital culture. You know, the School of Cultural Studies has long studied human cultures, and now human cultures are creating digital cultures that are global, that are transnational, and much of our lives are being technologically mediated. So how is human nature being transformed in the 21st century, the third millennium? How is human culture being transformed? And what does that all mean for Christian witness? How do we think about... So this is not just a question about how do we use technology to evangelize. That's one of the questions, and I'm almost of the mind that that may be not a very important question. I'm more maybe worried, more concerned with how is technology transforming human nature and human culture. I think understanding that is more important, because that also helps us understand how the church is being transformed. What does the people of God mean in a digital reality? How do we think about the nuns and spirituality in a digital and global context? How do we think about multiple religious belonging that is digitally mediated as opposed to quote-unquote carnally mediated? Again, not that the carnal part of us, our embodiment, is not important, but there's no doubt that our carnality and our digitality are now completely intertwined, right? So I don't think we've asked those kinds of questions about, you know, getting ready to read a book right now called Humanity 2.0. Who are we? What are we becoming in this kind of world? And what are we doing to ourselves as species and culturally? I think those are important missiological questions for us. And the last thing I think I'll say is simply something that I've already said, which is I continue to believe that Christian witness needs to keep developing in a with direction rather than a to direction. And that means that we're all bearing witness, if you will, with one another, and never only us as Christians bearing witness to other people, right? How do we live in this world of mutuality and reciprocity? I think those are important missiological questions for us as well.
So what would you say to someone who said, what do you mean by with? Give me an example. What does that look like, to bear witness with someone?
Well, I think, you know, certainly the example I gave earlier with the Jamestown volume, being able to sit with and listen to a native person tell his, or in this case, her story within the context of witness. Read my book, Hospitality and the Other, subtitle Pentecost, Christian Practices and the Neighbor, because I argue that the interfaith encounter needs to be one in which we participate not only as hosts, but as guests. That's what I call the with dimension, right? Because when you're hosting, you set up the table on your terms, you invite people into your space, you establish the framework of the conversation, you're in charge, right? But when you're a guest, you're at the mercy of the host. You're at the mercy of the others. In fact, you shut up until the others invite you to say something.
Yeah.
And I think most of the time when we think about hospitality, we think about us being in charge and inviting people into our space. Mm-hmm. And few of us have the abilities to actually get invited into other spaces, because most of us don't know how to be guests that could be welcomed. Mm-hmm. Right? But we're so busy telling people what to think and believe and do that why would they want to invite us to their place anyway?
Mm-hmm.
So that's another example where I think about interreligious relations as needing to be characterized by that kind of mutuality. And I provide a lot of examples in Hospitality and the Other about both apostolic and Christic mission involving guests and hosts.
Mm, excellent. Yep. Thank you so much, Dr. Young. I appreciate your time and generosity and for the things that you've shared.
Thanks, Martin.
Thank you.
God bless you.